Interviewer is Jonathan Woolsey. Interviewee is Commodore Doug McLean. The topic is on the Gulf War, the Persian Gulf War. So, when did you join the Navy?
I joined the Navy in September 1963, straight out of high school.
And what was the reason for joining the Navy?
Well, it really was to have some adventure in my life and see the world. And I had no money to go to university and at that time, and I didn't really have the inclination anyway, so I thought I'd do something else. I ended up going a lot of years to university throughout my naval career, but initially I wanted to get out and see some of the world and do something exciting. So that's what got me out of the prairies.
And why the Navy, Air Force, the Army, why the Navy?
Well, I'll tell you a quick story. My father, I didn't know it, but he had always harbored a wish to have joined the Navy when he was a young man. And he couldn't because he had lung problems all his life. So I didn't know that. He had never told me that. But as I was finishing high school, he, unbeknownst to me, called the recruiting office in Calgary, which was the nearest recruiting office to Lethbridge, Alberta, where I grew up. And he said, "You guys might be interested in my son." I didn't know it, so I was working at a service station after school and in the summers, and one Saturday morning the recruiting officer, who happened to be a naval officer, it varies across the country, it's just, you know, there's one recruiting officer in all the major cities, and he was a lieutenant commander in the Navy, and he came to where I worked on a Saturday afternoon while I was pumping gas, and in between filling up cars, he and I were just having a chat about this and that, and he asked me if I'd ever thought about joining the Navy. Well, I'd never been out of Alberta except three or four times in my life to Saskatchewan. Never been to British Columbia. Never seen the ocean. And I said, I'd never really thought about it. And he said, "Well, if you came to Calgary and passed a few tests, and a medical, and we like what we see, we would fly you to Ontario for a couple of weeks to do some other tests." And I thought, I've never been on an airplane.
Wow.
Never been out of Alberta, so I'm already getting excited, right?
Right.
So I said, "Okay, I'll do that." And sure enough, that's what I did. Passed the test, went to Ontario and met all these other really neat Canadians. I'd never met a French Canadian before. I'd never met people from very many places because I'd never been away from my hometown, really. So I met all these great young Canadians, and we became instant friends, and we all went through this process. I came back home, and a few weeks later, my father phoned me at work and said, "There's a telegram here from the Navy. Want me to open it?" I said, "Yeah, sure, go ahead." So he read it to me over the telephone and said, "We're offering you a 7-year short service commission in the Navy." And he said, "What do you think?" I said, "I'm in. I had a great time in Ontario." So about 33 years later, I retired.
And so what base were you in Ontario? Where were you trained?
We actually went to an old Air Force base. It's closed now. I can't even remember the name of it, to tell you the truth. It was near Grand Bend, Ontario, so we got to the beach. First
nice.
Time I'd ever been to a beach.
It's a very pretty city, too.
Yeah, I remember that.
Was the training realistic from what you encountered at sea?
Well, that was the initial selection process, but then I did the training once I signed up. I came out here to Victoria, and this is where our Naval Officers Training Center was. It was called HMCS Venture, which is the same name of this place. But in those days, it was in the dockyard.
Okay.
Used to be in the dockyard a long time ago. So we all went in there, showed up on the buses, and we spent a little over a year doing professional training, learning things about the Navy, getting very fit, and being assessed. And during that year period, we did a 3-month cruise to down as far as Chile and back.
Wow.
So that was it. So I, you know, within 3 months of joining the Navy, I was standing on a beach in Peru at 18 years old saying, "This is exactly what I'd hoped for. I mean, I'm seeing the world. You know, this is exciting." And we went on to Chile, and then went to Panama, went to Acapulco, a couple of stops in California and back home. So, and those were in warships. We left in 3 warships.
What ship was that?
They were, that was a ship called HMCS Antigonish. And they were World War II frigates. They were the last of the World War II ships still in existence in the Navy. So when I joined in September here, we had 97 people. By the time 3 months later we left on that trip, we were down to 56. And when we came back, they threw everybody out except 17 of us. Hmm. So they whittled us from 97 to 17 over the period of a year. Less than that, 6 months, I guess. Yeah. And the rest of us stayed for a long time.
When were you promoted to Commodore?
That was 1994. And I was then, as a Commodore, I was posted to Brussels, Belgium, to be the deputy representative for the Supreme Allied Commander Atlantic, he was called. And he's a four-star American admiral. Hmm. And I was his representative in Europe. We had a small staff there, about 20 international officers from NATO countries. And most of my work there was involved in, that was from 1994 to 96, so I was very involved in the former Yugoslavia when NATO took over from the United Nations there to try and stop the killing and the raping and pillaging and everything else that was going on there, right. Ethnic cleansing. So I spent a good part of my 2 years getting that organized and getting NATO troops in there.
What were you trained in to be, what were you trained to be in your trade?
I was initially trained as a junior officer as a navigator, and I navigated three ships on the West Coast here in my first few years in the Navy, and then I went to Halifax for a two-year specialist course, basically to be a warrior, and it was the operations officer's course, which was 2 years long, but that was all about tactics, weapons, how to fight the ship, remembering that it was the Cold War, so
ASW,
a lot of anti-submarine warfare, anti-air warfare, electronic warfare, anti-surface warfare, so ship against ship. So we spent 2 years really becoming tactical experts,
right?
And then I spent a couple of years in the ship as the combat officer for that destroyer. That was HMCS Marguerite on the East Coast, which a helicopter carrying destroyer. And then I that's when I first went back to university after that. Went to university for a few years, got my first degree. And
what year was this?
That was 1973.
Okay.
I went to Dalhousie University and got my degree, my bachelor's degree, and then I went back to sea to be the combat officer for a group of ships.
Okay.
So every group of ships has a squadron commander who commands that whole group. And I was his combat officer for a couple of years. So very much the rest of my sea time was spent, you know, as a warrior in those ships until I rose to be the second in command and then eventually the commanding officer of a few ships.
Okay. Who was a leader or a mentor you had in the Navy? There's someone that sticks out?
There's a couple, really. The first would have been my captain in HMCS Marguerite. When I first went there as a combat officer, his name was Commander Dick Heitzman, and H-I-T-E-S-M-A-N, and he was the finest warrior I ever met. He was a great captain. He knew how to fight his ship really well, and he taught me all that. So I was his warrior, but he was really teaching me in a lot of ways. And he was an outstanding naval officer, I thought. And so I always remembered him. And the other would be a gentleman who rose to the rank of admiral and rear admiral, and that was Tim Porter. And
P-O-R-T-E-R?
P-O-R-T-E-R, yeah. Okay. He's retired now and lives in Ottawa. And I had the good fortune to serve with him in one of my very first ships when he was a young lieutenant and I was an acting sub-lieutenant or a sub-lieutenant. And I saw in him, and he was just a young lieutenant, but he had this outstanding leadership ability that I really admired. And I had the good fortune about four times over my career to serve with him later on. When I was the squadron combat officer that I mentioned to you from 75 to 78. He was CO of one of the ships in that squadron, so I saw him then. And then a few years later, I came out to the West Coast here in 1978, to be the executive officer, second in command of HMCS Saskatchewan. And he was the captain. So he and I were the 1-2 team there, which was wonderful. And then a couple of years later, I got to be the captain of that ship. And by then, he was the squadron commander for that group of ships. So I served with him really 4 times throughout my career. And he was an excellent leader. And the third one I would have to mention was Admiral Mason. And he rose to be the commander of the Navy. But he and I served together as lieutenants in Marguerite and became good friends. And he, too, he was the smartest naval officer I ever met. Huge brain, really, really intelligent. Best organizational thinker I've ever met.
Outside the box.
Yeah. And a leader by example, which is the best way to lead. You know, it's not do as I say, not as I do. He did everything that he expected anyone else that worked for him to do. And that was a great lesson. And so he and I are still very good friends. He lives in he's retired in Halifax now. But as I say, the most intelligent and one of the best leaders I ever met. So those are the three guys that affected me the most.
Dealing with the Persian Gulf War, how many years have you been in the Navy at a time?
Well, that was 1990.
Yes.
So I joined in 63, so I'd been in 27 years by then. Just prior to that, I'd just taken command a couple of weeks before. So for the 3 years prior to that, I was in Virginia at the headquarters of the Supreme Allied Commander Atlantic. So I'd been out of the country for 3 years.
Okay.
And came back to Halifax, took command of Protector in June or early July in 1990. And then within a couple of weeks, they said we were getting ready to go to the Gulf War. So I hadn't been to sea for a few years. And I'd never served in that class of ship, so I didn't hardly know my way around there at all. And it had been a number of years since I served on the East Coast, too. And she was on the East Coast then in Halifax. So I didn't know anybody. I didn't even know my second in command. I'd never met him before.
And who was your second in command at the time?
He was a submarine officer, a submariner. Frank Scherber, his name was. S-C-H-E-R-B-E-R.
Okay.
Scherber. And as I say, he was a submarine officer, so this was his first experience in a surface ship in a very long time. So we were both learning fairly quickly together.
And the last ship you were on, it was not a supply ship, was
no,
it?
No, I'd never served in one of those ships before. My previous, the last ship I'd had command of was HMCS Qu'Appelle, which was a West Coast destroyer. And I'd had her about 4 years earlier. And then I was the commander sea training Pacific after I left that. My second destroyer command, I was the admiral's sort of expert here on commanding ships. So I would have a small group of officers and senior NCOs, and we would go to sea and make sure every ship was ready to go to war. And that was my job. So I was called Commander Sea Training Pacific, and I trained all the destroyers to make sure they were all, you know, ready for war.
So you were very familiar with the new technology that was coming in at the time?
Well, no, not really, because the that technology hadn't arrived yet. It hadn't arrived in our Navy. It was in other navies. And so I indirectly had some, because I worked in when I commanded ships, I had worked with the U.S. Navy, for instance, and the British Navy, which did have some of those systems in their ships. So we had some idea about what their capabilities were and how they would be best employed in a group of ships. But we did not, as a Navy, physically have those in our own fleet yet. They were all on the shelves in New Brunswick waiting for the Canadian Patrol frigates to be built. And they were just starting to build the first ones. And so all those weapon systems and electronic systems, sensor systems, tactical data systems, satellite communication systems and so on, missile decoy systems, all of those things were in a storeroom in a big building in New Brunswick, which is why we could get our hands on them so quickly and fit them to our ships in a few weeks. We actually had the stuff, but none of us had ever used it.
And it was supposed to go on another ship, not...
They were
going to
be put on the 12 new Canadian patrol frigates that we were just starting to build. So, you know, it's about a 6 or 7 year process to build a warship. So you start gathering computers and weapon systems and everything that you're going to put in those ships years before, a few years before. So you got everything ready to go when it's appropriate, when it's the right time to put it into that compartment of the ship.
Now, you were in Virginia at the time, you said, when you got the call to come up to work on the ship of Protector.
Correct.
What was your initial reaction to this?
Well, I was very pleased, of course, because there are very few opportunities to get command in the Canadian Navy, and because we don't have that many ships. So I had already had command of two destroyers, which is one more than most people get, and some people don't get any. So I'd had two, and I was hoping that I would, you know, be chosen for a further command at a more senior rank. And the supply ships are the biggest ships in the Navy, and therefore they were commanded by experienced officers of the rank of captain, one rank higher than destroyers are commanded, who had already had command of a destroyer, because the ship handling aspects are far, far more difficult. You know, coming and going out of harbor, getting ship alongside, maneuvering at sea, and all that sort of thing, they're way more complicated because they're not as responsive. And so you want a more experienced officer to be able to do that and without banging into things, sort of thing. So I was elated, to answer your question. I was hoping to come back to Canada to command at sea. That's what I lived for. Once you have a taste of it, if you're like me, it's the best job I ever had. So I wanted more command, and I knew that would be the last one, because there are no more senior commands than that. So it was going to be my last ship, but at least I was getting another one.
And what were when you found out that you were going to command the Protector, did you find out at the same time that you were going to also be boarding ships, or was this later on during the mission that you found?
No, that was later. That came later. Initially, actually, a bit ironic, my job in Norfolk, Virginia, was I was the chief of staff for exercises for the whole Atlantic for NATO. So we would plan 2 or 3 years in advance the big exercises that we would be executing. And as I say, remembering that it was still the Cold War, really, just the tail end. And I had planned in, with my staff in Norfolk, to run a really big exercise in the fall of 1990 called Teamwork, and it's one that we ran every 2 years, and there would be hundreds of warships, thousands of airplanes, and thousands of Marines, amphibious ships and so on going ashore in North Norway. That's generally where we did it. So we had planned the next one for 1990, and it was going to be done in the fall. So as I was told that I was getting command of Protector, I realized the Protector was scheduled to go to that exercise. And so I thought, man, I wrote that exercise. I mean, the book is 3 inches thick on where everybody's to be at any given time and how to make interactions between the various warring factions, blue side, red side. So I knew the entire plan. Nobody else knew the entire plan, not even the admiral running the fleet at sea, because I designed it, and we keep it a secret from them because it's to test them and their staff and everybody else. So I thought this was going to be great. I'm going to go and do a big exercise. I'm the only guy that knows both sides. I know the good guys and the bad guys, where they're going to be and what's going to happen. And so I thought, this is going to be really interesting to see how this all unfolds. And so when I got to Halifax in late June, early July, that's where I thought we were going. And the ship was getting ready to leave in a few weeks' time to go to that exercise. And I took command, and that was what we were going to focus on. And within a week of taking command, I got sent for by then Commodore Summers, and he and I are old friends as well, and called me up and said, Dougie, we're going to the Gulf War. We're going to the Gulf. And he said, we're not going to I said, we're not going to Teamwork? He said, no, that exercise is gone. It's not going to happen. And I thought, I just spent about a year and a half of my life building that thing, and now we're going to throw it in the garbage, which is exactly what we did. Because everybody that was going to be there is now going to be going to the Gulf, you know, most navies. And so the whole focus then changed immediately to we're going off to do something really real as opposed to an exercise. And at that stage, it was not yet decided what our employment would be. Although, as a supply ship, you know, I had a pretty good idea. I've been at sea with those ships and used them. I've been on the receiving end of all their stuff, fuel and food and spare helicopters when yours breaks and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, I had a pretty good idea that what my support role would be in a major operational deployment like that. What we didn't know at that stage was how much we were going to change the ship in that short period of time in terms of weapon systems and so on and crew. And we did not, nobody knew then at the outset where exactly we were going to be. In other words, were we going to be actually in the Persian Gulf? Were we going to be in the Gulf of Oman, a little further away? That was to be decided. And it wasn't totally decided by the day we left. It still wasn't clear. Initially, the government said that we would be going to the Gulf of Oman. So we would be outside the Persian Gulf. We knew that the ships we were sending, the three ships, Athabasca, Terra Nova, and Protector, were not modern warships, and therefore did not possess much in the way of anti-ship missile defense systems. And so that was the concern. That was the concern for the government and for the Navy, for that matter. So that's why it took a period of time to figure out exactly what it was we were going to do. And as we progressed towards Gibraltar and through the Mediterranean, Admiral Summers went to a meeting in the Middle East, in Bahrain, and spoke there to the U.S. commander in the area. And it was really, he'll tell you about that when you meet with him, but he came back from that meeting with a good idea of what it is we should be doing and what would be most useful for the coalition and what their needs were. And that one of their needs was that they did not have sufficient supply ships there. In fact, there were none. In the Persian Gulf itself, there were none.
Yeah, you the ship was
the
only
one. So we ended up being the only one. And then the business of us you know, actually taking patrol area and boarding and all that, that came a little bit later as a result of these meetings that Admiral Summers went to. He committed the Canadian ships to the U.S. commander. He said that we would keep two ships at sea all the time on patrol. Well, we only had three. So that meant, you know, I had to take a regular turn patrolling as well. And then the Americans were extremely keen to get their hands on Protector because they say they didn't have a supply ship there. So that meant their ships had to go off patrol and go some distance to get fuel and then get back on patrol. But with me there, I could actually fuel them on while they were on patrol and save them that trip. And what it translated into for them, and some of the COs of the U.S. ships told me this, is that they, because of that, they were able to actually get off patrol for maybe 48 hours and give their crews a break. So they'd go into one of the ports in the UAE or something and let their people have a breather. And up until then, they'd not been able to do that. So they've been basically on patrol all the time, whip away, get some fuel, get back on patrol. So the ship's company hadn't had any time off.
All right. With looking at the Sea King, have you ever worked with the Sea King before, the Persian Kid?
Oh, yeah. Yes. There were some interesting things on the air side. First off, Protector was built to carry three, a maximum of three. And we figured out during the process before we left that we could actually get four aircraft in the hangar if we parked them differently. So the hangar is designed to have two at the front end of the hangar and then one behind it. And so we found out if we angle parked them in the hangar, facing all in the kind of same direction at 45 degrees, we could get four in there. So we took four. So that's the first time, only time ever, that we've had four helicopters in those ships. And Athabascan took two, because she has a hangar big enough for two. And of course, Terra Nova didn't have a hangar at all, so she had no capability. So then we decided while we were out there, we were going to need helicopters all the time. So between myself and Athabasca, we would have to provide helicopter support for Terra Nova as well.
And would these helicopters usually look for mines, look for...
Mostly for, it had, you know, that was a secondary duty, to be on the lookout for floating mines and so on. But mostly we used our helicopters for searching for ships. And in many cases for speaking to them on the radio once they found them and clearing them, getting the information we needed, you know, their name, their port of registry, what they had on board, where they were going, where they were coming from. And then if we were suspicious about any of that, you know, then we'd make arrangements to have to board him. But quite often we were able to sort these ships out just by having a helicopter fly over them, identify them, and then talk to them and get that information. So it saved the ships from having to do all that, because I think my box was 20 miles. So, you know, you're 400 square miles there. And for my ship, it's hard to get around to all of that, for any ship, really. So the helicopters, that was their main purpose for, and in my case, the additional thing of supply. So if one of the other ships needed some spare part, you know, particularly quickly, whatever, then we could put that into one of the helicopters, send that over.
Right.
We did all the ferrying back and forth ashore from the airport for mail, you know, any kind of secret documents, key spare parts that were coming from Canada that we needed for one of the ships. My helicopters would pick that up, bring it out, we'd get off, get it over to the ship that needed it, sort of thing.
With going about leaving Halifax, what was the mood on the ship? Was it, the crewmen had just worked 5,000 man hours, would you say? Like 2 weeks worth in 4 days?
Oh, we worked our tails off there, day and night. I only went home for... I didn't go home for the first 5 or 6 days. I was moving into a brand new house I just bought, and I hardly knew where it was, but my wife was busy trying to get that organized, and we had people working the ship 24 hours a day, both dockyard people and our own people, hundreds and hundreds. We needed fire sentries from other ships. I had a crew of about almost 500 by the time we finished. Started with 240, and we ended up with going with almost 500 people because of all these new systems. And, but with all the concurrent activity, the storing of the ship, taking on fuel, all the airplane bits and pieces, all the spare parts that everybody wanted to take, I would take for them because we had the storage rooms. And then the fitting of all these systems. So that required a lot of welding, burning and welding, as we call it in the ships. They had to, everything has to be mounted because, of course, ships flop around. So everything, every bit and piece had to be welded to the deck. And so there were times when we would have, anytime there's a burning or welding going on in a ship, we have a thing called a burning and welding chit. It's a little piece of paper that authorizes them to do this. And it says exactly where it's being done. And then what you have to do, if we were in this room and the guy's going to do some welding right here, then you have to have a fire sentry here. You have to have a fire sentry on the other side of that wall. You have to have a fire sentry down below in the compartment. So if something starts coming through you know, the deck above, you can see that. So every time you have a burning and welding, and you need at least three people, at least three, standing by with fire extinguishers. Well, we had 40 or 50 of these jobs going on all the time. So there's 120 people right there, 24 hours a day. So we were actually getting people from other ships to come over and stand by and help us do that sort of thing. And so the ship was really chaotic. It was unbelievable, really, what was going on there.
It was very patriotic, too, wasn't it? People would not go home, like, and they were
absolutely.
Not even part of the military, but like from unions, and they will stay there.
Absolutely. It was... you know, it was one of those special, once-in-a-lifetime experiences, really, because by that time, I'd been in the Navy 27 years. I'd never been to war. I'd never gone off on an operation like that. I'd gone to sea a lot and gone away a lot, but not under that sort of circumstance where you're not sure exactly where you're going. It looks like this is going to end up being a shooting war. You don't know when you're coming back. I mean, every other time I left, I could always say to my wife, I'll be back in 3.5 months. I'll be back on such and such a date. Well, this time we couldn't do that, any of us. It was, the crew was doubling in size, literally overnight. So there was a whole bunch of new people coming to the ship that, you know, didn't know exactly how they fitted in and how this is organizationally. A ship has to have an organization that, so that everybody knows what to do at any given moment, depending on the situation. They have, you watch the old movies, these action stations, where the gong goes off and everybody runs to their action station, and everybody has a specific job to do and a place to be, and so a supply ship didn't have action stations. It didn't have an organization for that because we didn't have any weapons. Action stations is for weapons, for shooting things. So we had to design all of that in the midst of all this other craziness. We had to find another couple of hundred bunks for people to sleep in because I'm taking twice as many people as I was ever taking before. We were literally taking hundreds of bunks out of other ships and finding places that weld them into this ship.
You're taking things out and just like putting hammocks in? And
absolutely, yeah. Yeah, bunks and some people slept on the floor and sleeping bag on the deck and for a while. And as I say, then you get this whole new crew thing coming together, so everybody's trying to get to know everybody and see what they got to do.
Right.
I had my first experience ever of having women in my ship, because when I was last at sea a few years earlier, we didn't have women at sea. And when I came to Protector, I had 55 women in my ship's company, so that was a whole new experience for me as well. And how was that going to fit in, and how was that going to work? The ship's company were outstanding. I mean, it was everything I hoped for. You know, you train all those years, and you don't go to war. But you hope that you've trained well. And you hope that all these other people are properly trained, and that when that time comes, if it comes, everybody's going to rise to the occasion and it'll be a good thing. Well, that's exactly what happened. Likewise, the dockyard, unbelievable. Those guys worked day, night, 24 hours a day, like I said. I actually went to sea I had 36 hours to go to sea and trial all the new weapons. And so when I went, I took at least 100 dockyard people with me. They were still burning, welding, doing all these things while we were at sea, firing all the new weapon systems. And then came back alongside 36 hours later, and they were still doing it. It was unbelievable. I got phone calls from people that used to serve with me in other capacities and other ships saying, sir, you need me. I want to go with you. I'm the best guy in the Navy at this particular thing. I got those kinds of phone calls every day. It was really something. So everybody rose. I had one bad experience, and that was a petty officer. Like I said to you, I didn't know any of these people,
right.
So they were all new to me. But I had a petty officer who'd been in the Navy about 22, 24, 25 years, something like that. And he came to me and quit. And he said that he didn't want to go. So I didn't have to let him go, actually, because although we're a volunteer force and so on, we have the authority in times of emergency to say, you're not quitting, you're going. I could have done that,
right.
But I had no desire to take that man with me. And so I said, are you telling me that you, for 25 years, you know, you've taken Queen's shilling, as we call it? I mean, you know, you've been paid for 25 years, and the first time you're asked to go and do something that might be a little dangerous, you don't want to go. He said, that's right. I said, get off my ship. One guy out of 500, so that's pretty good.
No, that's a good ratio. Like, I thought there's probably people that took his spot, right? Like, people stepped up.
Absolutely.
Didn't have to go look for anyone.
I didn't want him. I sure didn't want him there.
Now, when you got out to sea, you did some practicing with the Her Majesty Commander, HCMS Fraser, right?
Fraser, yeah.
And was that tactical? Was that what you were expecting?
Yeah, what we were doing then on the way across to Gibraltar and then from Gibraltar through the Mediterranean, what we were doing then was particularly in Protector, all the ships had one or two or three or four new systems in them. My Protector had 20. I mean, we had 13 weapon systems that were not there before. We had anti-ship missile decoy systems that were not there before. We had new radars. We had a tactical data system, which all modern warships have, but the supply ships did not have. They actually put one of those in, so we can electronically bring all this information in from other ships, process it, and look at it on a screen. So we had to learn, we had to integrate all these systems. And so the Protector certainly had the most challenging job to get all that stuff working properly and in the right sequence. And so on the way across, we took Fraser with us for the first week or so, and she would act as a raider, somebody that would come towards us at high speed, and you know, we'd figure out which of our systems to use at certain times. We could try out our jamming capability on her, a number of tactics that we were wanting to use. So she came, I guess, halfway across with us, if I remember correctly, there, but, and then we sent her back. Hmm. And then once we finished, left Gibraltar, we went into the Mediterranean, and we had a French aircraft, an Atlantique, with a missile head hung underneath it from an Exocet missile.
Right.
And we used that to try to figure out how to best use our anti-ship missile defense systems to protect us against an Exocet missile. That was one of the two missiles that that Saddam Hussein had. So, so he had the Exocet missile on Mirage aircraft, and he had a Silkworm missile, which is an old Chinese missile, that he could fly on his MiGs. And those were the two anti-ship missiles that we had to face, and they were quite different. They had different characteristics, different ways of finding them, and we had to figure out the best way to decoy them and to protect ourselves, and in the end, if need be, shoot down the missile with our close-in weapon systems that were fitted. So it was really quite challenging. You had to figure out very, very quickly, within a matter of seconds, which of these two missiles it was, because you had to react to them differently. And if you reacted to the wrong one, all you did was make sure that a missile was going to hit you, because right. you would go towards it instead of away from it, sort of thing. So that was crucial. So that was the other thing that we were practicing all the way across, getting that stuff going.
So can you tell me about the Vulcan Phalanx?
Yeah, the Vulcan Phalanx is an American close-in weapon system specifically designed to allow ships to shoot down sea-skimming missiles that will otherwise destroy your ship. So they fired depleted uranium 20mm ammunition, which is a bullet about 6 inches long and about an inch around, 2,000 a minute. So it really literally puts up a wall of depleted uranium, very, very heavy metal, that the missile then has to fly through, and it can't. Mm-hmm. I mean, it comes through and it flies into pieces. And the pieces of that missile are probably going to come on board the ship. But the fact is that the warhead itself will have been detonated, and the biggest plus is that the unexpended fuel in the missile, which is usually what causes these huge conflagrations, fires that are spread throughout the ship almost immediately, because the thing goes through several different compartments and the fuel is spreading and lighting fire all at the same time. So all of that fuel will have been exploded. So by the time it gets to you, because this happens only a couple hundred yards from the ship,
right?
So you're going to get shrapnel and stuff on board, but you're not going to get this huge explosion. It's the thing that sinks ships.
And especially for a supply ship,
We were full of fuel,
yeah.
Aviation fuel, ammunition, spare missiles for the other ships. I mean, we were a Roman candle, potentially.
Yeah.
And so I had two of those Vulcan Phalanx, one forward on top of the bridge and one aft on top of the hangar.
Did you have any trouble with them?
No, I did not. Ours worked beautifully, and the only one that had any trouble with it was Terra Nova, and hers did not work, or at least it didn't work consistently. And it was a huge demoralizer for that ship's company, because we all saw this as our real true last line of defense against the missile, and a very proven one, a good system that really worked. And Terra Nova's problem was that theirs would keep breaking down, and the ship's company, every guy in that ship's company knew
when that thing wasn't online, wasn't working. And it was such a demoralizer that Admiral Summers at some point came to me and said, I need to take one of yours and give it to Terra Nova. And I said, the reason I have two is because I have a very large ship here that's very unmaneuverable. And, you know, I'm the most vulnerable of the ships. And, as you said, I've got all this stuff on board that when it blows up, it's going to really blow up. So I wasn't real keen on giving that up. But in the end, that's what we did. We gave the major part that the Terra Nova required to them. And I got another piece. It took a while, but I got another piece from the Americans, and we got it fixed.
Now, EMIs, electronic magnetic disruptions with the wiring. Now, did you have a lot of trouble with that on the ship?
No, I didn't. The real advantage, the one advantage that Protector had over the other ships, the other two ships, was that I had a lot of real estate. So there was more room to put things than there was in the smaller warships.
Mm-hmm.
So we were able to place things in various positions so that we were quite sure they wouldn't interfere with each other. And we really didn't have any of that sort of mutual interference kind of difficulty. Everything I had worked. And that's a testament to the people that put all the systems in such a short period of time. I mean, it was pretty amazing, really.
Mm-hmm.
And every time I went to sea, I fired every weapon system to make sure the thing was working. Everyone.
And it hadn't been it's been a while since they've shot missiles and...
We'd never shot missiles. Well, at least I hadn't. I mean, I'd never had anything to shoot. So, all the systems were brand new. Well, I should say that. The systems that I said at the beginning were from the Canadian Patrol frigates, or meant for the Canadian Patrol frigates, were all brand new.
Right.
But then we also installed a bunch of older weapon systems in Protector. So we, for instance, we put the 3-inch 50, installed a 3-inch 50 gun back on.
Is that the 40 millimeter?
No, we put 40 millimeters on as well. So
there was some controversy about that.
Yeah,
that it's been ancient. Used since 1940.
The first gun I ever fired in the Navy in 1963 was that 40 millimeter gun, and in 1990, I had it on my ship and I was going to shoot it again,
mm-hmm.
almost 30 years later. And they were old when I fired them; they were World War II weapons.
Right.
The 3-inch 50 gun, which is the big one that sat right up on the bow. And it was quite a large weapon. I mean, you know, the shell is this big, around, you know, it's 4 or 5 inches around, and it's that long.
Okay.
And so we put that back on the bow. We felt that we could use that. It had been on the bow originally, and then when the ships were first built, and that ship was built in 69. But within a few years, they took it off, A, because it was a pretty old gun. It was a World War II vintage gun, too. And B, it was very vulnerable up on the bow. So in the North Atlantic, when you're plowing through big seas, a number of times the gun shield, the protection around it, all got knocked off.
Mm-hmm.
And so they took the gun off. And the ship had not had that gun on there for 20 years. Mm-hmm. Just about 20 years. So they put it back on.
Okay.
So those were the older systems. And then we had 50 caliber machine guns, which were great. We had those all over the ship. Again, to ward off small boats. So all those weapons, the 40 millimeter, the 3-inch 50, and 50 caliber machine guns, were all anti-boat protection. And then the anti-air protection was in the form of those close-in weapon systems, the Vulcan Valens, and the various decoy systems that they fitted, which again came from the shelf for the Canadian Patrol Frigate.
And you were confident with these three, the 40 millimeter, 3-inch 50, and the 50 caliber. You had all faith in that.
Yeah. I had two concerns. One was the anti-ship missile. That was the biggest concern, really. That was the thing that that even with those Vulcan Phalanx, and we also had the Army missiles on board, Rapier missiles that the Army fires in the field. But we had their little tripods, and I had two teams, one up on top of the hangar, one up on the forecastle, forward. And they had an IR, an infrared homing capability, so they might... They would never be able to shoot down a missile. They might get lucky and get a shot at the airplane, but it was just a little extra protection, really. But it was all about those Vulcan Phalanx as far as anti-ship missile defense went. And then the other The only other concern I had that I could do nothing about was the mines, and the floating mines. And the difficulty there was the Protector was built to a commercial standard, so she's not a very quiet ship. And so if you have an acoustic mine that goes off based on the amount of noise being made by the ship itself, by the engines, the boilers, and so on and so forth, the machinery, she's a very noisy ship. They were built that way, and there's nothing I could do about that in that time frame that would allow me to get quieter. So I was very vulnerable to acoustic mines. And floating mines, if they were magnetic, that's the other thing. The ship was very dirty magnetically, so you know, if you park the ship for a very long time in pointing in one direction, it actually becomes magnetized because it's such a big piece of steel. And she had, over the years, become quite magnetized. And there are coils, electrical coils in the ship that you can adjust, put a certain amount of current through various ones to try and neutralize that. But she had, and then every once in a while, in a ship's life, you actually wrap huge coils all the way around the ship, and you pass a current through it, and you basically demagnetize it. Well, that hadn't been done, we couldn't even find out when it was last done.
Wow.
So the ship was magnetically very dirty as well. So I was very, very vulnerable to mines. And I had to count on the fact that, that we had a few patrol boats that had escaped, Kuwaiti patrol boats, and a few others up to the north that were there looking for the mines, because there's a general water circulation in the Gulf that's counterclockwise.
Okay.
And so if you threw some mines in up off the coast of Iraq, they would float down the coast of Kuwait and Bahrain and the UAE, and I was down there a little bit. So we had to count on those patrol boats picking up the mines, and then they'd send divers or something up to blow them up. And help, they had some helicopters, U.S. helicopters, doing that too.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, we were keeping a very close eye out ourselves in our own area, but they'd have to get through a couple of other opportunities to be detected before they got to me. And so, you know, I wasn't too worried about that. I mean, it was a concern.